Started, go for the goal.
It should be all set.
Can you hear me from afar here like this?
Oh, yes. No, that's fine.
That picks them up good and tight, huh?
Yes.
Great.
Let's begin then by indicating that today is March 30th, 1995, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Keith McKinnon at the Holiday Inn in Scottsdale, I think.
You're in Scottsdale.
Okay. I know you were born in Condon, Oregon on Christmas Day in 1933, and that you subsequently received a B.S. degree in agricultural chemistry from Oregon State. I understand that why your interest in agriculture comes from your family background, but what about your interest in chemistry? Where did that develop?
I suppose it would be fair to say with a high school chemistry teacher named Lauren Studer, who was a graduate of, I believe, St. Olaf's College in Minnesota. And Studer introduced me as I was, I guess, a junior in high school to kind of the wonders and mysteries of chemistry, and I got fairly fascinated with that. I was not a, how would I describe it? I was not a good student in the sense that I didn't work very hard, but once I get curious about something, I'd get into it fairly deeply, and chemistry seemed easy for me and fun for me. So maybe that was part of.
Where was this school located?
That's Pendleton, Oregon.
Okay.
Pendleton High School, yeah, good question. One other thing that might be interesting as a matter of historical record, you mentioned I was born in Condon, left there, by the way, at quite an early age, 4 years or something like that. Condon is a city of, I mean, on a really big day when it's festival time, it might be 50 people or 100 people. But in normal time, it might be 30 or 40. And I discovered that one of the kids who went to school there, and I'm fuzzy now on exactly what years, but I think grade school and much of high school, was a guy named Linus Pauling. So here's this little town, I mean, we're talking little in fairly obscure parts of the United States, where a man of that caliber, you know, kind of went to school. Who knows? Maybe that inspired me some. I still have his. He was the class speaker when he graduated from Oregon State in 1922. And I'm the possessor of a copy of that speech to this day. Mm. You know, that was a lot of years before I was in Condon, or before I was a junior in high school, probably 30 years or something, 25. But maybe that has something to do with it. Or, I don't know. But Mr. Studer certainly.
Did you have a lot of laboratory experience in that high school course?
Some laboratory work. Actually, it had, and again, this is a long time ago, but my memory is we had kind of the typical for the time chemistry laboratory. We had our little sinks, and we'd, like probably every other kid in the history of the world, take a little piece of sodium out from under the oil and throw it in the water, and you know, that kind of stuff. We did do. Mm-hmm. It was not all books. We did do some real laboratory stuff.
You went to OSU in 51, I believe.
Right.
And
you've done your homework well, sir.
I understand that your father graduated from OSU, your grandfather graduated from OSU, so it was sort of preordained that this is where you were going to go.
As did my mother.
And your mother, too.
Yeah. So
which was unusual at that.
Yeah,
I
think so. It was a struggle for them. My dad learned to value college very much because I think partly because it took him so damn long to get through. He had to work a year and go a year and work a year and go a year, and of course that was right in the Depression. He was there in 32, graduated in 32, so he was right across the Depression of that. So that, it would not have been wise for me to fail to go to college. He was pretty emphatic about that.
I'm not sure what constitutes a degree in agricultural chemistry.
Yeah, it was a what was done, and I, maybe this is not entirely accurate, but I'll give you my perception at the time. I was in the School of Agriculture and taking chemistry.
Okay.
Agricultural chemistry was in the School of Chemistry. I wasn't a great student, but I, in the School of Agriculture, I was not bad. And they were trying to keep kids from leaving agriculture and going off into chemistry, so they developed a curriculum for upper class, junior, senior years, called Agricultural Technology, which basically was 100% electives for both years. I mean, you could take whatever the heck you wanted, kind of, and it permitted me to take all the chemistry and stay in the School of Agriculture. I didn't much care where I was, I guess, but a lot, I had a lot of freedom there, and I could take prodigious numbers of courses. I remember I typically took 19 credit hours a semester, term, I guess we call it, three terms, I guess. So I did a lot of that stuff, and the degree in agricultural technology was, in fact, what I have. I say agricultural chemistry. Had all of the chemistry and a fair amount more of business-related stuff than you'd get in the chemistry curriculum. But it didn't have the German.
Mm.
The reason I didn't graduate, you know, with a B.S. in chemistry, because I ducked the German requirement, which wasn't the requirement in the agricultural technology. It was the fundamental difference. I thought, why the heck do I want to do German? I mean, we just won that war. Yeah, you know, I suppose that's what I thought. That was, by the way, quite a mistake. If I had anything to do over again as I were starting into, say, high school, maybe even back further now, I would get a second language. That's my single biggest regret from that. I didn't do it.
Were you aware of the Pauling legacy at OSU?
Yeah.
When you were the student?
I was. Pauling was at Caltech and doing wondrous things. You know, remember, I was at OSU about the time that Watson and Crick did their wondrous magic, and Pauling was heavily into that, as I'm sure you know. So he was a Caltecher and hadn't maybe developed as much of a, well, how would I say it? His mind was occupied with other things than Oregon State. And it was in his later years that he warmed to that, and that became a big deal, which is now quite a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, every February 28th from now on will be Linus Pauling Day in the state of Oregon.
Really?
Just as an example, okay. Yeah, by proclamation, and the last one was the first one, and I had the high privilege of having dinner with Sir Francis Crick.
Oh, marvelous.
There, you know, kind of to celebrate the event, and Crick gave a lecture about Pauling and all of that, so that's become a major, and I was aware, but it wasn't as big a thing when I was in college, but awareness, yeah, I mean, it was. The chemistry department took some significant pride in the fact that it had a Nobel laureate who was one of their undergraduate students.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he'd won his second Nobel Prize. That was a Peace Prize, and that came much later.
Yes, yeah, that would have been, I think, in the 60s.
Somewhere. Yeah, but he remains today the only individual to have two unshared Nobels.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear that a lot when you're in court.
I was interested in what you said about the this degree program, which had a business component to it also.
Yeah, I it was unclear to me whether I would be best served trying to spend my life in a white lab coat or whether I wasn't maybe even competent to do that. I mean, I was learning that there are some pretty smart kids in the world, and all of a sudden I was having to work a little bit, and some of them were kind of blowing by me. So I thought to myself, ooh, you may not be all that brilliant in the research business. Maybe you better learn a little bit about the rest of the world. So I consciously took some business courses. You know, it always seemed to me that almost without exception, wherever I ended up, I mean, you can take a bunch of fields. You can take law or medicine or agriculture, or you kind of pick one. Having a basic degree and knowledge base in chemistry, I thought was going to be a pretty good deal for that. If I were going to be a business person, as long as it was in the chemical-related industry, I thought that would be good. So I concluded for myself, and have advised all the kids I get a chance to advise since, nothing wrong with it. You don't have to go be a PhD and chase Nobel Prizes. You can go be a chemical peddler or go, you know, do something else. Mm-hmm. Go be CEO of General Electric, mm-hmm. as well as either a chemical engineer or a chemist. I mean, so, and there are a lot of ways to use that. And I tumbled early to the fact it might be smart to have a hole card.
Okay, great. Did you do any kind of research as an undergraduate, or was it strictly coursework?
No, I spent one of my summers. I mean, my three summers between my college years were kind of interesting. One of them I drove a Caterpillar pulling a combine. And one of them I was a craps dealer in Reno, Nevada. And one of them, the last one, I spent at the Oregon State Agricultural Experiment Station doing chemistry for a fellow named Dr. Virgil Freed, F-R-E-E-D, who was head of the ag chemistry department there. And he invited me to spend the summer at the laboratory doing stuff. And that was probably, in retrospect, one of those little chance things that had a huge impact on where I ended up, because I worked on a method for the detection of 2,4-D residues. Mm. At the time, 2,4-D was big herbicide. And today's sophisticated techniques for detection weren't exactly available. And darn if we didn't discover one using something called chromatropic acid, of all things, which would detect at, for then, pretty low levels and get a nice purple color and a cleft spectrophotometer. And so we were, I mean, this was an exciting summer because we kind of got that done. We got it in the Journal of Ag and Food Chem very quickly because everybody was looking for that kind of a thing. So, I mean, for a college undergraduate, it wasn't exactly Sir Francis Crick discovering DNA or something, but it was a kind of a development, and Dow was a big 2,4-D producer, and it kind of caught their eye. So I suspect that's one of the reasons that they were anxious, maybe the wrong word, but prepared to interview me when they came to Oregon State.
How would you characterize the chemistry department at OSU at that time?
You know, in the context of chemistry departments in other universities, as I know them now, I would say it was mediocre to adequate, not top tier. I feel differently, by the way, about the chemical engineering department there, which I believe is one of the best in the country. Chemistry, I would say, was a mid-range department. Lots of, even in those days, foreign graduate students who were teaching some labs and stuff that were a little hard to understand. And that may be too harsh an appraisal, because I wasn't nearly as motivated until toward the end of my... I was relatively immature in college. I would say perfectly capable of getting very good grades, but not particularly interested in getting very good grades. I discovered a lot of things like fun, girls, and, you know, all that stuff immature kids kind of do. And it was only the last year or so, a couple of years maybe, that I kind of snapped out of that and got serious about all that stuff. Then I started to get more from the university than I had before, and that's probably more my fault than its fault. I think it was perfectly capable of teaching me a lot more than I learned. So, but I wouldn't agree. I would still have to say kind of an average. That reminds me of another funny thing that I probably shouldn't tell you, but I will. The seven or eight of us who were the senior executives at Dow one time were sitting around reviewing the criteria we use for interviewing prospective employees. Science qualified. We had all this stuff, grade points and all this stuff. And one of us, maybe me, said, okay, guys, now, no baloney. How many of us, under these criteria, would have been eligible to be interviewed? And the answer, I believe, was one of the seven. We were going to do it to ourselves with all this. And it was kind of an eye-opener about how things have changed and things have changed. But I would not be an interviewee in today's schedule. I don't know whether Paul might have been. He wasn't part of this group. He'd left by then. Paul probably was. He probably had pretty good grades. Some of the rest of us weren't so red hot there. So I mean, maybe there's a message in that about what works. Mm-hmm. But
did that last summer experience whet your appetite for research?
It certainly whetted my appetite for chemistry. And I think it's fair to say the answer to that is yeah, we were quite successful with something that had been a fairly intractable problem for others. And I guess I thought, yeah, this would be fun. I can't remember. I don't think I ever seriously considered applying for graduate school.
Okay.
I think, how would I phrase it? I was broke, and maybe subconsciously at least smart enough to know I wasn't going to be competitive with the great minds of the world in chemistry. And here were some guys offering me a job with a chemical company I liked. So frankly, that option never occurred to me. And in those days, you know, BS chemists could find pretty good jobs, and they weren't, if you will, just a pair of hands for a PhD somewhere or something. They were doing our own stuff. So I just went off and did it.
I understand that your father, Rex, said there were two companies that
yeah.
were worthy of consideration. One was Dow and the other was Stauffer.
I just
remembered now who it was that I talked to in Key Largo, and that was H. Barkley Morley.
Oh, you did, huh?
So it finally came back.
Yeah, Bark and I are good friends. We see each other every summer.
Oh.
And we have nice visits every summer in a very nice place on a nice patio and relive some of our past transgressions and glories or whatever.
And I think you've already described why you selected Dow over Stauffer in your interview with Ned.
Yeah, I mentioned my dad's comments about Dow Corning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably pretty well in it.
So you started at Dow in 1955, title of research chemist, and a special assignment.
I suspect that research chemist was probably today chemist one or something. Mm-hmm. Entry level chemist is what it was. Research chemist sounds classier. I was chemist one.
Okay. One of the things I'd like to do as we follow through your career here at Dow is to sort of focus on the research environment as you experienced it.
Be glad to do that.
So let me ask, what it was like when you started there in this particular group? And as I understand it, this was you had a number of short assignments that were involved in.
Yeah, I went through a training program, which was a number of 6-week assignments in different departments. The rationale for that was, let's see if we can find a good fit between your capabilities and your interests and the department's receptivity. So a lot of us went through that.
Okay. Where were you first?
I was at an agricultural experiment station in South Haven, Michigan.
Okay. What was your reaction to get here you are coming out with a BS degree, you've done some good research, you've got a paper published, and now you're at a good chemical company. What was your reaction to these early assignments?
Yeah, first of all, the program was terrific, because I got a chance to learn a lot in different places. That first one, and I may have mentioned this to Ned, that first one was a particularly interesting assignment, because there's one thing I knew a fair amount about. It was agricultural chemical experimentation. I'd even lived on an agricultural experiment station. So I was a great trial to the folks running that agricultural experimentation in South Haven, because by my own modest admission, I knew essentially everything and was in a position to teach them a lot, you know. And I'm sure they thought, oh, what have I got? What do we got here? You know. But they were patient. And as a matter of fact, years later, that was 55, so it would have been 35 years later, I had the pleasure of presenting a 50-year pin. A guy had worked 50 years to a guy named John Davidson, who was the guy running that station when I came there that first day. So, I mean, it all comes around, and John and I have become very good friends since. But I know I was a trial to him then, although I'm not sure he ever quite said that. My reaction was, this outfit knows what they're doing. They're doing some good stuff. I'm going to like this. But again, I was at an agricultural experiment station, and I wasn't in the big plant. I learned some things very quickly. I remember driving from South Haven to Dow's Midland Division, called Midland Division. And I was smoking a cigarette as I came up to the guard gate, you know, to go in. I learned a lot about safety rules. That guard carved me up big time. And that was just what he should have done. Mm-hmm. So I'm out of this.
Where else were you?
What other special projects?
Right.
Yeah, I worked on... I went from that experiment station to a organic synthesis laboratory where I was working on a new synthesis for 2-methyl-4-chloro-phenoxyacetic acids instead of 2,4-dichlor, MCP that was called. Worked there for a while. I did a project. I think one of the great things that every chemist ought to get a chance to do is work on the fundamental problem of soil stabilization. Everybody wants to stabilize soil, and you got about 1 cent per million tons to do it with, so it's an impossible problem. Nobody can do it for the economics or all that. I had a project like that. I worked on coating citrus. I believe, boy, it's a little fuzzy now. We were coating citrus for the purpose of maintaining its freshness and retarding the rate of spoilage. And then I had this project in Dow's Western Division working on water-soluble polymer technology for flocculation, solid liquid separation. I believe those were the projects. I believe I have now named them all.
Okay. How would you characterize the research supervisors that you were working for?
Highly variable. First of all, they were inherently arranged. There were some relatively young new ones, and there were some old hands who'd been around forever. And we're talking the mid-50s, of course. I would describe them as universally competent, interested in what they were doing, relatively unskilled in human resource management and interpersonal relations and all that. I mean, everybody was flying by the seat of their pants, kind of. And in cases where people didn't have inherent competence, that was a bad deal. Where they had it, I mean, arguably it's better than today where everybody's overtrained for that, you know. I'm not sure where that all sets out, but there was a pretty wide range.
But was there, would you say that within the company or within these different groups that you were at that point, an attitude that that we want to do good things, that we want to be creative in some sense in solving these problems.
Always that. I mean, attention to the task, commitment to the enterprise, and affection for the company were pretty much universal. I don't recall ever having someone say, you know, why am I working for this blankety blank outfit? Did never see any of that. There was lots of commitment to the enterprise by everybody. I mean, their ability to execute varied, as I've said, but their level of commitment was universally darn good.
How much flexibility did you have as a young new recruit to the company? Or in terms of your input and ideas as opposed to somebody saying, this is what you should do?
It was very surprising to me, but the answer is lots of freedom. Lots of freedom, a lot of attention paid to ideas that I had, lots of, maybe more than was deserved in some cases. But I did not ever feel a constraint in that context. I'm just surprisingly ready. One of Dow's great strengths, in my view, was its willingness to push decision-making down, to invite ideas to bubble up and not get too suppressed, and all of that. And I was working on a hot project. I was working on, for much of the time, my first full-time job was in using water-soluble polymers for oil recovery, as you sure know. And Mr. Doan had a personal interest in that and some other people. So it may be that I was in a somewhat unusual situation, but I always felt plenty of support, plenty of freedom, never a question with that, as long as I was kind of committed to stay in the research organization. Once I started to make sounds about wanting to go sell something, then we got a little different ballgame. But within research, they were fair to me, good to me, no complaints, lots of opportunity.
Ray Bondi has used the term accountable freedom.
Yeah, I think that's a good term. Yeah. It isn't as though we could all just go order what we want and do what we want. Accountable freedom is quite a good term for what I felt I had there. Yeah, I mean, for a young chemist, we may not have recognized it, but those had equal importance. On the accountable side, that's what makes you grow up and be a productive manager. The freedom side lets your creativity work for you. I like that a lot. Accountable freedom is a very good term.
Now, just as an aside, I was very fortunate to have two sessions with Ray a number of years ago.
I envy you that. He had that book. What was it? Yeah, it was a book about, it was a physics lab book, I guess. And I had a dinner for all of the people who contributed to chapters of that. And Ray was the guest of honor at that dinner. I thought that idea up. I said, let's just have a nice dinner. And Ray came, and Sylvia Stacer came. Mm-hmm.
We talked to her.
Did you? You got her.
Ned and I.
Terrific.
Spent a couple hours with her, and she was delightful.
Oh, wonderful woman! It may be that was her last kind of public thing, mm-hmm. that dinner that mm-hmm. I had. So I was very pleased with that. early when I was there in 1955, because Don was working in the research department, working for Bounty, and he was interested in this pusher thing, and so I got a little bit acquainted with him. Good time.
You've already mentioned and the reluctance of your boss when you said you wanted to go sell chemicals. Oh, let me back up one more moment.
Sure.
Yeah, you came in with an ag background, but you didn't stay in ag very long.
That's true. The Aggies, I wanted the Aggies more than they needed me.
Okay. And how did you feel about that?
Okay, because for two reasons. First, this polymer business was a chance to get right back to the West Coast, which I was kind of looking for. And B, that was a pretty interesting area in chemistry, and these were romance projects, and everybody was paying a lot of attention to them, so I thought, well, there'll be another time for ag. And there was, 30-some years later. But,
yes.
But it didn't bother me.
Okay.
Not a problem.
What possessed you to say all of a sudden, and I guess you'd been 5 years doing research in the research area, I want to go sell chemicals rather than do research?
I guess, Jim, I didn't believe that I would advance to the senior levels of Dow's research organization. And I don't want you to misunderstand that. It wasn't that I had some goal in my life then to become president of something, because I really never had, never ever had that kind of objective. But I wanted to do well and, you know, achieve things and be personally satisfied. And while I was doing good work, I think, in the research area, I watched a lot of other folks. I came in contact with a lot of Dow's marketing and TS&D people. And I envied their chance to get acquainted with people outside the company and see what's going on in other places and do other things. I was so naive at the time that I thought, well, the best way to learn that is to go out and be a field seller somewhere. And what I really wanted to do was be in what we call TS&D, technical service and development. Development's always the thing that I charge my batteries the most. But I was having trouble getting to that from research. So the selling thing was, I just wanted to find out for myself whether I had the ability to interact with people and whether I had the kind of skill set that it took to be really good in it, because I knew I was doing okay in the chemistry, but I wasn't going to be probably a world beater. And I just got curious. I just wanted to go find out. About that simple.
But apparently your research had been pretty good, because they didn't want you to go.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know how good the research was. It was certainly true they didn't think much of my going. I mean, I contributed a lot to this project. It was getting off the ground. And that got to be a little battle of wills then, as you can see from what I said with my boss, that I don't know, you can't go. And I said, wait a minute, I've already decided I'm going. It's a question of with who, and, you know, that gets to be kind of... I liked that fellow very much. I was in the Dave Pye, a terrific guy. But I called his bluff. He called my bluff, and then I called his. And neither of us blinked, kind of. So off I went to Shell to sell ammonia.
How did you make the contact with Shell?
I don't remember. I don't remember with certainty. My dad was at something called the Pendleton Grain Growers up there in eastern Oregon, and that was Shell, maybe largest, but one of Shell's largest ammonia dealers. And it's possible that it was through that. I might have just written them, because they were just down the road from Pittsburgh. They were out there fairly close. And I might have just written them a letter. I'm embarrassed to say I don't exactly remember.
And how did you feel selling?
Enjoyed that a lot. You know, it's totaled. I mean, I moved from this white lab coat out there in a manufacturing plant to a desk in the heart of downtown San Francisco on the 100 Bush Street on the 9th floor. You couldn't hardly get more downtown than that. And I don't believe I would have been happy doing that for a long time. But the change was so great, and the opportunity to interact with people. And yeah, I'm just a phone chemical salesperson, but I'm scheduling rail cars and trying to find better ways to get cheaper freight rates, doing a whole lot of stuff that I didn't even know existed in the world. And I enjoyed that for the time I did it, which was only 18 months or so. It's a very good experience. As I told Ned and have said many times, the two best professional things I ever did in my life were leave Dow and come back.
And as I understand it, Dow called you.
Yeah, that's true. What had happened there is that a bunch of patents had started to develop from the work I'd done before. And they had decided to take this show on the road, if you will. So they kind of come back and said, gee, we think you might like to be in the technical service and development function, developing this thing that you know more about than anybody else. So we're going to offer you this job in PS&D to go do that. I mean, you know, if I'd written the job description before I left of what I wanted to do, that was kind of it. So I'd kind of done this other thing for 18 months. I knew how to do rail cars, and I mean, I kind of had that. I'd satisfied myself, yeah, I can do that. So it was perfect. Perfect.
Somebody up there knew what you wanted.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, yeah. There was some divine guidance. It wasn't great skill on my part. I was just lucky.
So that was 62 when you
right.
went back.
Exactly right.
And, gee, you were there 5 years with the, still working on the Pusher project.
Yeah, I was, you know, that was the 5 years in which we went to every major oil company in the country and said, here's a good deal for you, why don't you sign up? A lot of them didn't sign up, but some of them did sign up. And so that was a busy 5 years. You're right. From then, 5 years there and then off to Houston.
Were you more involved in the sales aspect of that as opposed to the development aspect?
If you're thinking of development in the sense of research or chemistry, I was more involved in the selling of the process.
Okay.
And the technology, then developing the technology. But a lot of what was going on then were actual field experiments with these companies. And we'd be out on some big oil field somewhere. As, for example, in the Queeley Dome field in Wyoming in the middle of the dang winter, sitting on a wellhead putting this polymer in the ground and hoping a lot of oil came out the other end. I did a lot of that.
Okay.
So in that sense, development of the process and getting it sold was the combination. I'd convince somebody we ought to go try this in their field, and then I'd be the guy who got to go out and try it in their field.
Was it a relief when it worked? I mean, were there times when you did this and it didn't work?
Yeah, you know, work gets to be one of these definition things. In that process, the idea was you thicken up this water, it'll get more efficient than pushing oil out. That always worked, I think, basically. But because the water was thicker, you had to push harder on it or it didn't go as fast. And even though it was more efficient, it didn't get more barrels out the back end because it was harder to push. If you, and all these oil guys care about is how much oil comes out the end. You know, well, efficiency, the hell with that. That's 10 years down the road, that extra oil. We're talking now. So sometimes that didn't work. But it was a peculiar thing, and I'm sure, I mean, I must have mentioned this to Ned, that was a time, particularly in Texas, where they had restrictions on the wells, what they called allowable amounts that wells could produce. If you went to the commission and proved that you were using an efficiency-improving process, they'd raise the amount that they let the wells produce. So, and that was a perfect deal for them. They'd go to the commission and say, we're using this new process, which is going to get more efficient. But of course, it's expensive because we've got to buy all this chemical. So you got to let us increase the production so we can pay for it. Well, that was a good deal. Because then they had the money to pay for it right up front, and they knew they were going to get more at the end. And everybody's a pleaser. You know. So it wasn't that the process got you more oil at the front. It was that the commission let you pump more oil at the front. And then you got more later. It was very interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of an unusual deal. But I remember going in front of the Railroad Commission and testifying that, yes, they are using this stuff, and yes, here's the technical reasons it'll work and all that. So we sold a lot of that stuff to get some allowable raise, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing something like that, how much proprietary interest is there in the technology? How much can you reveal and not reveal?
Yeah, we were pretty careful about that because we wanted that stuff injected in all the inert environment. There were things we did with the polymer that kept it from adhering to the clay and the steel so that it wouldn't get lost and hung up as it went through. That was fairly proprietary stuff. We were pretty careful with it. We had a long lead on anybody else at that point. We kind of wanted to retain it. And we had some pretty solid patent positions. But proprietary technology was an important part of that.
Let's see, you were in Houston then.
Right.
67, I think you went to Houston.
Right, I remember because it's the year the Astrodome opened.
Oh, okay. It's too bad they're not playing baseball in it anymore.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, that's kind of that thing you mentioned about how many people were on the Mayflower. It's kind of like how many people saw the basketball game between Houston and UCLA when Houston had Eldon Hayes and UCLA had Al Cinder.
Right.
I think it was still the most watched college basketball game ever. And probably 8 million people were in that little stadium. But I was one of them.
Really?
I didn't go to the game. Yeah.
Marvelous.
I was on that Mayflower.
Marvelous. This was SWRD, I think, the Secondary
Oil
Recovery Department,
right.
Which you closed down.
Yes, sir, I did.
Was that your idea, or were you given orders to do that?
I was given orders to stop the research activity in the Western Division. That's what I shut down. That's the research where I'd started back in the mid-50s. My instructions were to gracefully phase that out. I mean, gracefully in the sense of managing employees properly. And the reason for that was we decided to transfer that technology and the activity to Dow Well.
Okay.
Which is where it belonged, basically. It could belong anywhere, it belonged there more. So my job was to go back to my old starting point and make it disappear. Not a particularly pleasant assignment, but one that I think we got done okay.
This wasn't the last time you were going to be doing something
That's
like
true.
This.
That is true.
And of course, it really tests one's ability in managing people when you're given that kind of
it
assignment.
Does. It does indeed.
But it's looking at an overall research management aspect. Is there this? Research changes as time goes on, and so you've got to look at how you can consolidate and best manage your resources. How do you make those kinds of decisions? Is it a business decision? Is it a bottom line decision to say, all right, this research group's got to be phased out?
Yeah, ultimately it is. In the purest sense, I guess, bottom line, you kind of say, I say kind of three things. How productive is this area likely to be in terms of value? How expensive is it likely to be in terms of cost? And what are my alternative uses of those resources? If I can get that figured out, I can tell you what to do with that project.
Mm-hmm.
I can be wrong about my guesses on any of those things. But I mean, somebody's got to judge, and I mean, that's kind of what it amounts to. And that, one of the problems, of course, with research is being dispassionate about it. I mean, you get into a project and it's yours and you want to make it go and you're the project champion. Better there be somebody somewhere who's kind of dispassionate and has to pick between those. I don't believe that's, I can't speak outside of the Dow world much, but to the extent I have any sense at all, I don't think that's particularly well done by industrial chemical concerns today. I don't think that's done thoughtfully enough. I think there tends to be more focus on the trees and not enough on the forest, I will say to you. Everybody puts together what we used to call swag sheets, you know, scientific wild-ass guess sheets about what we're going to do about two of those three things at least, not usually the alternative, the first two. And the focus was always more on getting those in and getting the ritual done than standing back and really saying, wait, we're going to use 30 people on this for 3 years and nobody can tell this is going to make synthetic earwax, for crying out loud. Nobody's going to buy synthetic earwax. And we got too much earwax, you know, or eyebrows on frogs or whatever. That wasn't done rigorously. It may be today, but it was not done rigorously enough during the time I was involved in. My view.
For lack of any other word, several people have told me as we were looking at factors that are involved in decision making, that one factor, not the only one, but one factor ends up being instinct. You can make all of these judgments you can put on paper, but somewhere along the line there's some instinct that you can't define that plays some kind of role. Did you experience anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, and I would agree with that, at least in part, maybe dissent in part. Instinct can be based on, at least, historical information and experience. I mean, instinct isn't something you're necessarily born with. So you get into a little semantic thing about what's instinctive and what comes from what you know, your knowledge of the people involved, your sense of the kind of the broad parameters that are driving society in a particular direction. Are we really going to need advanced plastic materials, like everything? You know, all of those things become part of what folks call instinct. But in the sense you don't have any good numbers or anything, and you gotta make your best guess, and that I will accept as instinct. What I prize most highly, and if you were to ask Orifus, he would tell you, I for some reason happen to possess in abundance, or at least he keeps telling people I do, is not maybe instinct, but common sense. And I think those two things either intertwine or kind of need to go hand in hand. I mean, it's a little like playing poker. Your instinct might say, I think he's bluffing, I'm going to bet everything. Your common sense might say, I think he's bluffing, but I can find that out for one more dollar and save all my money for the next hand. You know, all I got to do is call him now. I don't have to put it all in there because I think he's bluffing. Well, maybe that's a silly, semantic way to show the difference between instinct and common sense. I think both are pretty handy. But I would agree that instinct is part of effective research management. For that matter, effective general management. Not just management of research development or project priorities, but a lot of other public perception, which I've spent a lot of my career doing, involves some instinct for what you think the reactions are going to be. A little like that.
Yes, you touched on this just before. You have this possibility, and especially in research, of feet little fiefdoms growing up. And everybody's out there selling their idea to management instead of looking at how all of this interacts. And was that a problem at Dow?
You bet.
Part of human nature, I guess.
There was a part of human nature. Now, you know, Dow in the 50s and 60s, in a sense, turned that to advantage by letting those fiefdoms compete one with the other on the same project. I'm sure you've heard about that from Pruitt and Martin. All these guys will tell you kind of how that was done. I suspect that was productive. And I mean, from the shareholders' sense, I will tell you that it could be a little languishing on the interpersonal relationships. But that's what they did. They said, yeah, we get fiefdoms. Let's give them the same project and one will win. And that is a way to deal with fiefdomism instead of having everybody have a different one and do it, you know. So, yeah, I it's a balanced deal. You can't have fiefdoms. I mean, another example of that, as the world becomes smaller and more enterprises have to think in a global context. And I'll use agriculture as an example. You know, you get your European ag company and your U.S. ag company, you're a big company and you got all these geographies around. And here's a compound that is, let me use a hypothetical example, really good on the wheat spectrum in Europe. Maybe your second best compound in the U.S. spectrum, and maybe really good in Latin America, let's say. Well, the U.S. doesn't want you to develop that compound, because for the U.S., they get another one that is really good. The practical problem is you don't have enough resources to develop two compounds. So somebody's got to make a judgment about which one you're going to do. And if you had all fiefdoms autonomous, you'd be doing two, even though you couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of thing that has put an extra dimension on research management. I could make some general management scenarios for the same kind of thing. But it gets more complex now as we're trying to do global models of things. That wasn't true in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It's true today.
Well, in a similar context, of the story I remember from, I think it was Willard, some researchers went to Willard Dow and they said, Willard, we've got this process, we want you to support this group. And we know it will work because it's the way DuPont does it. And Willard said to them, if we can't do it better and differently than DuPont, we're not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, who knows whether that really quite happened that way.
Right.
Those are the great lore stories. We got to do it better and cheaper. That's kind of one of the old songs. Dow has ridden that horse a long way, and it's still kind of a touchstone. But better, let's say, when you get global, I mean, different areas are different enough that the same thing can't always be better in different places, particularly in biological molecules. I mean, weeds are just plain different. You know? Maybe humans and pharmaceuticals are somewhat that way, too.
After you took care of Seward, you went back to Midland.
Right.
And that's when you were involved in process chemicals.
Right.
And I pulled out a quote from your discussion with Ned that I wanted to follow up on. Your
sure.
Your boss there was Lewis
Carmouche.
And you said he wanted the department to be the best, wanted to try creative and new and unconventional things.
That was Louie.
Could you expand on that a little?
Yeah, Louie was, I mean, Louie had us do everything from, man, I can't remember all this. Louie was willing to test concepts. He had a department that was more open to that, but Louis would take a flyer on some novel idea further than any other department general manager. If he thought that, I can remember us working on everything from Indian baskets to camouflage for military application to propellants for airbag devices. I mean, all these just really unusual kinds of activities. And Louis loved those and embraced them and nurtured them and would unload them when they didn't play. I mean, he had the ability to say, okay, we tried that, now we go to the next. But nobody minded because there were always so many. And he was very fertile. I mean, we did stuff in his department. We built these great big domes over sewage treatment plants, and you know, we got ourselves in a little trouble here and there with some of that stuff. But he was a creative fellow and loved that.
And did that permeate throughout the group then?
Yeah, kind of did. Kind of did, yeah. We were all frontiers persons with Louis at the helm.
He almost sounds like a reincarnation of John Deasy.
Louis wasn't a researcher. He was a manufacturing guy by training. But if Louis had been in research, that'd have been Grevy again.
Mm-hmm.
Sure would have been.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
There were a number of things that happened at this point. I'm not sure I have it clear in my own mind because you had all kinds of different responsibilities.
Oh, yeah, I went through a lot of stuff.
Environmental control systems, highway products, construction materials, which was before you moved into the government relations part. But here again, you were involved. Well, you said as business manager of environmental control systems, I preside over more bad stuff longer than probably any business manager in history.
That's probably true.
Well, we come back to this whole business of how long do you let something that's bad go on before you pull a plug on it.
Yeah, and it's a tough judgment call. I think I was a young business manager with a good research background. And, I mean, we all loved the company. We were all pretty competitive. I mean, we wanted our stuff to do good. Human nature will do that to you. And it's just not natural. I mean, it's harder for a young business manager to say, this stuff I'm doing is a bunch of nonsense. I ought to demise all this and, you know, take myself out of a job here. That's not the side of the coin that most people look at. They look at the let's make this bigger and better and faster and all the rest of that stuff. It took me a while to come to the realization myself, this ain't going to serve the company well, as best I can judge where it's headed. So why don't we sell these things off to people who would like them better and maybe do better with them? And get the hell out of here. I was slow to reach a conclusion there, and I followed. I should have reached it sooner. Louis was, my boss, was tolerant of that, because it wasn't as though we weren't making money and weren't doing, I mean, we were doing okay. Well, this wasn't some big red ink deal. But it wasn't going to go anywhere. And one of the concepts of that was, this is now, we're talking, 60s, early 70s. Earth Day is here. There are going to be huge opportunities in the environmental area. Companies will just make a ton. That was the prevailing wisdom. I had to buck that. So, hey, I think that's going to be very slow income, and I don't think it's going to be very good returns. I don't think we got the right cannons anyway. So, I mean, I almost had to sell the idea of stopping some of this stuff. But hindsight, I sleep well in hindsight on that set of judgments.
But it was hard to do, and I presided over some stuff a long time that probably shouldn't have gotten presided over that long. What I said was true.
Did you have to sell Louis, or did you have to sell further up on the chain of command?
What I did was sell Louis. Louis kind of took that forward, but I got a note, either a note or a phone call. I can't remember. It may have been a phone call from Ben Branch, who I'd not even met. He said, "I see you sold the surf pack business for $250,000 on a supply contract or something." And I thought, And then he said, "That's just exactly what we ought to be doing with this kind of stuff and with this business, and I compliment you on having done that." You know, so it was a nice thing for a little guy who'd never even met Ben Branch to hear or read, and I think I heard it. So Louis done a good job up there, or Branch felt that way anyway. Carmouche, as I told Ned, was fairly tough on his employees, and he was progressive and direct, but nothing compared to the way he was with his bosses. He derived a great pleasure out of tweaking his boss. He was hell on wheels. He hadn't had that streak, and he might have run the place someday or something, but he hacked off enough people that he never did get there. But he was something. Quite a guy.
Another one of these was AmSpec.
Right. Which was created way in advance of my being there, but which I had to be part of the decision to eliminate. Yeah, AmSpec, again, as I told Ned, was in the business of selling styrofoam and some other Dow products, but it began to sell products. It began to see itself as a selling company selling anything for the 5% commission in selling. And that isn't what Dow needed. What Dow needed was somebody to sell a hell of a lot of styrofoam on which it made 40%, and not a heck of a lot of everybody else's stuff on which it made 5%. So it ultimately had to come back in the fold. It was expensive. It was duplicating sales offices, duplicating field forces, and it just wasn't headed the right way, at least in my judgment. I did have to sell Louis. That was a harder one for Louis because it was his creation.
I was going to say, that sounds, from what as I read that, that must have been one of the more difficult ones.
That was very difficult. Emotionally, a lot of people involved. They had a great esprit de corps. It would be like dissolving a Marine Corps and putting it back in the Army.
Okay.
Not easy. Mm-hmm. Particularly when your boss is the commandant of Marines.
Great analogy.
Yeah, well, and a great tribute to Louis that it got done, I would say.
In 1976, you really changed directions.
Did for a fact.
And you said to Ned, "I think the company needs someone to spend more time with external influences." And this was your feeling. How did you reach that decision?
Earth Day had come. The environmentalists were, how would I say, vigorous, active. The federal apparatus for environmental protection was building. The EPA was growing fast. The Federal Water Pollution Control Act and the Air Act were all coming. And as I listened to my colleagues inside the company, their general reaction all that was, "Hey, we're doing stuff right. Please, those people just go away and don't bother us. You know, trust us." And I thought to myself, I don't think that's going to win the war. And we better understand some of these things and where they're headed. So it was in fair part environment related, but maybe a little more of a, you know, the public is going to get more independent and assertive here, and we love our plant communities and they love us and we kind of own each other. But what about somewhat larger environment and all of that? Dow had a great product stewardship program. I was very proud of that. It wasn't well known. I thought, gee, maybe there's some opportunity in this as well as dealing with the problems. And I just want to understand that better, and nobody else was very interested, like, to me. That was an area where I used to say it's a little like raw milk. Everybody goes and gets pasteurized, you know. I mean, if you get somebody you kind of can't find a place for, you want to kind of put them out to pasture, you send them to government affairs. That is dramatically changed since, but it was a little bit like that in those days.
Well, the chemical industry had a long history of stonewalling.
Right. I think that's fair.
Rachel Carson.
Silent Spring
was
not everybody's favorite reading in the chemical business.
And of course, that's changed drastically, but it certainly was a hard, long road to get there.
Yeah, and I mean, there's room for criticism on all sides of that, in my view. I mean, I think a lot of the leaders of the chemical industry were kind of the old school, good old boy network. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I think some of the environmental people on the other side would have found things a lot more productive if they hadn't taunted and teased and used their shock troop tactics and some of the other stuff. So, I mean, it was just kind of there was no way to dissolve that interface. That's only they give Gerstacker credit for, you know. He recognized that problem early and did, I mean, it was in the late 60s or so when he did either his profit and pollution control thing. And that was very insightful, I think. The way it was done and the way it handled. I can remember the luminaries of the strip of Ralph Nader himself quoting that and saying, oh, there's a guy who knows what's going on. You know, so Gerstacker at least had that focus pretty early.
This change to government relations was actually, that was within the plastics department, wasn't it?
I moved to the plastics department. I said, if I'm going to learn a new area, I might as well learn a new technology, too.
Oh, okay. Now, who did you have to sell to get to this point?
I had to convince Louis, and then, as you'll have read in there, everybody thought I was out of my tree, you know. Okay, what's wrong with you? What have we done wrong? What can we fix so you don't act like a dummy that you're acting like? And then I had to convince the general manager of the plastics department that I was a rational guy for doing that. I was a guy named Kyle at the time. I had to convince those two guys.
Okay.
Kyle has since become a very good friend. In fact, so I'm in Florida last week.
What was government relations like in the company as a whole? Was this really quite new, or was...
No, I think there'd been a historical government relations department. I suppose Dutch Boydell as much as anybody. He had a lot of political connections, and he kind of knew Lyndon and, you know, all that stuff. But in terms of an organized dealing with the kind of stuff I saw coming, we didn't really have any. Generally, I mean, we had a lot of political relationships, but no department designed to. And to a degree, that was true with the communication. We had a bunch of communications professional folks, but they weren't cohesive. Mm-hmm. There wasn't an integrated, here's what the company really thinks kind of deal. Ned holding the fort against napalm, or somebody else worrying about something else. You know, it wasn't very cohesive.
Now, what kind of an agenda did you set for yourself?
Well, I was just in the plastics department. So I didn't have any big corporate. I mean, I was still undiscovered, as I would view it at that point in time. I was just kind of doing my little thing there. And there were two issues early on that I kind of dealt with. One was, okay, what should our position be on the so-called bottle bills, you know, bringing back the cans and the bottle. And the other one was the banning of plastic milk containers in Minnesota. Minnesota, the state legislature decided they were going to outlaw, it's a big paper state, they're going to outlaw plastic gallon jug. So I kind of took on those two crusades, and my, you know, kind of as a lone eagle, went off and, particularly the milk jug one, kind of went and did those things. So it was a time in my life where I'd gone from being a business manager with all this responsibility and all this activity, kind of being just my own little person doing this one thing in relative obscurity, which is okay.
I understand that your testimony in Minnesota caused the company to...
Yeah, I told Grant that story, didn't I?
Yes.
Yeah, right, about the $10 million that was sitting on my dark side.
Right.
Yeah, right. Well, that's right. I told them what I thought, and there were some folks that didn't like it too much. To their everlasting credit, the down managers involved said, if you said it and it's right, we'll stick with you. It's kind of a great story.
Well, that aspect is showing up throughout people I've talked to at Dow. the support that comes from above in a decision that's controversial or causes some problems, if you're right, if they feel you're right, you'll get all the support you need.
Or even if you may not have been right, but you learn from it and don't make that one again. I mean, the classic Branch thing, I made more mistakes than anybody, but since I decided so many things, I had a better 50% record, and, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everybody, I don't know if it's still that way or not, I've been away for 4 or 5 years, but I like to think in any part of the outfit that I was ever in until I left, people would say that. Hope they would. That's good for the outfit.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, by the way, I think that helps nurture that, this is something that may be right here, is I talk, and I'm in a lot of other industries now with jobs I have, and I talk with other people. Everybody is just stunned by this rule Dow has that its employee directors have to leave their jobs at age 60 or 5 years. You're going to lose all this talent, you're only 60 years old, blah, 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 blah. But it forces people at earlier ages to learn how to do stuff, and it forces them to delegate stuff. And there's just this big cascade down of that kind of support that I think comes, at least in some part, by the fact that you're going to have CEOs that are between 55 and 60 instead of between 65 and 70. So somebody who's 45 years old, which is not very old, at least by my current view, is only 10 years away from being CEO of a company. What? Yeah, wow. So I think that's one of the things that works there.
That whole procedure was Ted Doan's idea, wasn't it?
I believe it was.
Yeah.
Another of his great contributions. The business manager concept was one. That's one.
Well, in 1978, your life changed again. The company's life changed drastically in 1978. And you've discussed with Ned in some detail the events surrounding the change from Zoltan to Paul Orifice. But
yeah, we probably ought to not go through all that again, but I'll do what you like here, sir.
Well, no, I think what that is...
We got what we need in there, probably.
Yeah, I think so. But I wanted to look at your relationship with Paul.
Yeah, good.
And how you dealt with public issues.
From the day I first met the man, I have great respect for Paul as a leader. I think he has more instinctive leadership skill than perhaps anyone I've ever worked with. He really does, if you get just down to the fundamental things it takes to lead, Paul has those gifts in abundance. Nobody can lead like that without having a lot of self-confidence. Nobody can have a lot of self-confidence without at least being perceived as having a fairly strong ego as part of that. I mean, I think it all kind of goes hand in hand. Perhaps where I was, and if you said to me, tell me two or three things which made you and Paul work well together, which I think is maybe where you're headed here, it was... Probably that I wrote like he talked so I could communicate with him. That I was perfectly willing to tell him when I thought he was off the mark, but I did that carefully and in private, you know, so that I didn't have a... Because I could, at least at some level, anticipate the things that would really help him do his job. So I guess the way that all happened is I was working for Mr. Kyle in plastics. I even think maybe, and Orifice was president of Dow US, the US company. And I think Kyle maybe said to him, you know, in effect, although maybe more delicately, Paul, you need a gopher doing this job. You know, you need some stuff. And once he got a kind of yes to that, kind of, I got a kid over here who I think might be pretty good for that. So that's how all that kind of came together. And I was pretty good. I worked hard at that. I enjoyed that, by the way, a lot. It was fun
to be one step ahead of the big boss for stuff, and I could get there once in a while, you know. And so our relationship was always very good, and as you know, has remained good to the point that I invited him to introduce me at the medal ceremony this fall. We're still good friends. Talked to him yesterday, as a matter of fact.
During that time period, we're talking, well, starting in 78 especially, let's say 78 to 82, there were a number of problems that had to be dealt with. You mentioned Ned handling the napalm part.
Right.
There was the plastics combustibility problem and PVC and so on. And this really then led, as I see it, to you're being influential in trying to change Dow's public image. This comes back to what we were talking about earlier. Don't stonewall anymore.
Yeah, I had the job, Jim, that had that as part of its job description. I mean, what was I? I was responsible for communications function, the government affairs function, and at least at some point or another, the legal deal. All three of those are the ones that ought to be... Anyway, so it just kind of fell to me to do what I could to facilitate that change in thinking. And, you know, I can sit back and say, boy, yeah, I did a great job there and, you know, changed the course. I can say all that stuff. The fact is that the driving forces for causing that change were pretty dramatic. I mean, it probably would all happen had I not even been there. I might have facilitated the use, but I mean, you know, you didn't need to be a rocket scientist to understand that the public is going to be served. And so I may have made some of that easier. Paul, to his great credit, I mean, Paul had been pretty unforgiving of big government, pretty anti-government spending and government waste on, made a lot of speeches that, how would I say it, weren't the favorite cup of tea of the environmental community and some other places. But Paul, to his credit, knew, you know, that the winds of change are blowing, and kind of let me pursue that. When we had a good understanding about that, and he was very supportive and helpful while maintaining his public dislike of big government and waste and all the rest of that.
Were you able then to convince him to, did he change in any respect then, eventually?
Yeah, I'd say that he listened to me thoughtfully. I think toned down may not be quite the right word, but put a different slant on some of the things that he chose to say publicly, and was comfortable with my suggestion maybe other people for specific situations who might be a little less combative than he would be, and so he didn't have to do it all the time. And I think all that worked. I mean, there were situations where his natural combative nature wasn't the optimum kind of attitude to have going into something. And while he kind of wanted to get in there and get it done, you know, we respected each other a lot. I hope he would tell you that when you talk to him tomorrow. I certainly felt that way about him. And we had a good relationship, and I think that served the company extremely well, because he was able to retain, you know, to fulfill that role of a leader when the company badly needed one, and you were able to kind of change the company's perception of itself and the perception of the public of it, all kind of in one time frame there.
Let me follow up for a moment on what you just said about the public image, but
yeah.
after Zoltan, the change between Zoltan and Paul, the internal image of the company. Were there problems there, and did that need to have attention?
You mean because of the change between those two guys? No, I wouldn't speak for Europe, where Zoltan had a large following and was much beloved, because I wasn't there. I would say in the U.S. that was met with a general sigh of relief, and then the corporation with a general sigh of relief, and oh boy, now we'll know what's going on, and we'll get back to business, and we got a guy here who's going to lead and work hard, and, you know. This guy plays tennis instead of having other kind of extracurricular activities, and we can call and get back to work. I think that was the first. So that wasn't a tough transition. I mean, it was, might have been a little tough from Europe, but Frank was there, and I don't think that was too tough either.
Let me just raise another question, and that is, how far the turmoil that might be occurring at, or tensions that occur at the highest level of the company, how far down does that reach?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is surprisingly, a surprisingly short distance. I think maybe more at Dow than a lot of other places. People are too busy doing what they're doing to spend all their time worrying about what's going on up there. You know, I mean, they read the tea leaves and they kind of understand what's going on. But I don't think that's as big a factor at Dow. Maybe a couple of other reasons for that. You know, if you're having that trouble in General Motors, it's on the front page of the Detroit Free Press 4 times a week. I mean, every day, you know, gee, Schmale's in here doing this, and poor old CEO Bob can't do that. You know, I mean, it's just in Midland, Michigan. I mean, the Wall Street Journal doesn't come and write about Dow. So there isn't a big public thing, you know, and the newspaper is more into stories about what the Boy Scouts are doing, you know, and they'll do Dow's under report. So there isn't anything that feeds that in the same sense there is in other places. You know, it's not a Business Week story. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's part of why. The answer is not so deep.
Okay. Well, 1982... You were back in the ag department.
Yeah, I got back to you. See there? I finally made that purple. Yeah, I sure did. Yeah, I had a great time there. And I like to think we set a course in 82, 83 that has served that ag business really well.
And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that you got the individual groups who were working only in their own little area to work as a unit.
I got them all. I said, guys, we're the board of directors of Dow's global ag business, and we're going to have to decide some very hard decisions, but we're going to do it, and we're going to do it together, and then we're all going to do our Omerta thing, sign in blood, and go get the best results we can get. And, you know, everybody thought about that a while. I said, oh, what a great idea, and off we went.
So it wasn't a hard sell at all.
It wasn't bad. I mean, it was great. You know, it's like a lot of things. It was great in concept, and everybody signed and all that. It's when the first real excitement, when the first real one comes up, it gets a little harder. But I had an unusual group of people there, I really think, and they understood. They came to play, and I switched a couple of them in jobs, so the old allegiance had to be different than the new one, you know, and you do a little of that, and you dissolve up some of that parochial stuff. It all worked fine. Dramatically improved the performance of the enterprise, made it possible to join it up with Elanco into what is now a good going machine.
It wasn't long after that, well, you changed again, but you were group vice president. You had, again, a number of
different things. Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff for that. Well, let's pass over that. That was pretty short.
The dioxin affair came up, and here again we come to this whole idea of the public understanding of chemistry.
Yeah, what happened there was kind of dioxin and Agent Orange, you know, all of that stuff began to foment dioxin being the impurity that was in Agent Orange, and then stacks and some other things. Yeah, that's probably the second big way turn in my life, coming in professional life. The first one being when I went to government affairs there, and then this one being when this thing became such a pronounced public issue, because the public had seen pictures of Times Beach and the white suits and all of that stuff. I won't go over it again, but you'll read in there I told Ned about the CBS camera crews coming to Midland to try to do their second Times Beach, and they couldn't find a room because the place was crowded and all that. That was a wonderful story, which I love to tell. But again, that was a situation where a lot of common sense and some instinct are called for, and you don't have a lot of time to grapple with those. That's one of the other things. A research thing, you can take a week to decide. This stuff, it is instant.
you know, the phone rings and there you are. And I think I had some flair for that. So, you know, I'm not, worked hard on it anyway. When you get tired of this, then let me know.
Oh, no, listen, do you have any time constraints?
I have, Pat, I told her I'd try to get head back out not long after 11 o'clock.
Okay.
So we got a half hour.
Okay. Just a couple other things about your career, and then I'd like to go to
sure.
this list and
yeah,
pick up
should.
A couple things
I think
there. Of course, 1992 was another major change in your career when you were thrust into the limelight again after handling the dioxin and all the press coverage there. Now all of a sudden you really got a baptism of fire with it.
Yeah, now
you're
a big one.
Right. That was but what I'd like to talk to you about with the Dow Corning affair was again this whole business of research and how you manage it and how you listen to what people are saying. I mean, you really came in as a troubleshooter, as it were. You weren't involved in any of that earlier,
right?
But
right.
apparently some of this goes back some years in terms of some potential difficulties, and whether or not people are listening, is this a matter of somebody pushing an idea without paying attention to some of the other detail? I don't know. I was just wondering how you reacted to that.
Well, I've asked the people who were there a little about that, and I mean they say some interesting things. They say, look, all over the country, women are injecting themselves with hypodermic needles and silicone gel. From all over the country, we get physicians coming to us saying, you know more about this chemistry than anybody else. This is the inert stuff. Can't you make some kind of a sack to put this stuff in so we can quit having women do this to themselves? And they make a fairly compelling argument that they felt an obligation to be in this business, because they convinced themselves that these things were important for women, and if they didn't have them, they were going to do something that was pretty stupid. And then they'd go on to say, and we thought we might build a pretty good business about this, recognizing we're going to make much money with this, we might make a bunch of money in the medical business. I mean, that's, I've oversimplified, but that's in essence what I heard people say. I think one could say you want to be very careful if you've grown up in an industrial chemical environment, suddenly making products for human implantation, direct use, whatever, because at least in today's world. It was a little different then, because all these things were kind of grandfathered, and these were devices, not products, and all that stuff. In today's world, you know, you need to have some pretty sophisticated kind of capabilities to even consider being in that stuff. I don't think Dow Corning had them, nor really knew what was required, and the FDA wasn't requiring much. And they thought they were doing something to help a lot of people who otherwise might hurt themselves. But I would have to... It's not possible for me to judge, I don't think, the level or the quality of the research done at that time in the context of that time. I would have to say today I wish some of that had been more indifferent. But I'd be reluctant to judge it then. If you ask me the fundamental question, was that a smart business for Dow Corning to be in? That answer is easy, and the answer is no. And I said that way before this controversy came along, just on its merits. I mean, I don't think we have to make any money with this. I don't think that's the best use of our resources. I mean, on the three criteria that I gave you before, it didn't cut it. So that was always an easy judgment for me. And I felt that way and have said so way before I ever got involved with Dow Corning.
Did you... how shall I phrase this? How were you received at Dow Corning?
Yeah, they were ready for the White Knight. They were ready. I mean, I would say to you that Dow Corning had the reaction any of us have, and that's kind of the sea anemone reaction. When something pokes it, you know, it balls up and puts the spines out. And... my approach was quite different, and that one wasn't working. So I was, and I wondered if people would say, oh boy, here's Big Brother thrusting one of their own in here to tell us what we're doing wrong or whatever. I wondered about that a little bit, but the situation was difficult enough, and the need for somebody to be decisive kind of on anything was great enough that that was just not a factor. Not a factor, I think. I doubt if, well, you might find one. You might, out of the 7,000 people there, you might find one or two just soon I hadn't shown up. But you'd find 6,998 that would say that was a good deal, I think.
Mm-hmm.
My nature is, I could have had more trouble, I think, if I'd gone over there and closeted myself, you know, in some room and started issued proclamations. But that's not my style or nature. I'm out there talking to everybody, finding out what the hell's going on, and asking for opinions, and being very decisive about judgments. And no problem with that.
How did you react to that assignment? I mean, here you were essentially winding down at Dow. You talked about taking this early retirement and so on, and your road was clear to going back to Oregon. And
yeah, I talked with Ned about that a little, and you'll see it in there, I guess. It was a very painful decision for me. It was a painful decision, which I would not have made had I not been asked. In the context of it, is Dow asking me to do this. No individual would I have done that for. But I have an old-fashioned view of loyalty and obligation, and I mean, it sounds corny, and I can't help it. That's what, from a personal standpoint, it was. I mean, you know, I've been through one cancer, and worked for 35 years kind of without taking a break, and I had the break all lined up, had the house bought here, had everything kind of done. And I mean, I knew that was not going to be an easy deal, so I didn't want to do that very badly. But once having agreed to do it, I mean I gave it everything I felt I knew how to, so it was okay. But it was not, How did I did not seek that office, I guess would be fair to say. Yeah.
One of the things you knew was that you were going to be in the national spot.
Sure. Absolutely knew.
And in today's world, that's such a glaring spotlight.
Yeah, it was pretty dramatic. I as you probably read, I did a Larry King show 8 days or 10 days or something after getting my job, after being at Dow Corning. And everybody said, how could you possibly do that? I would tell you, it's a lot better to do it after 8 days than it is after 45, because you don't have to know everything after 8 days. But it was pretty interesting. I mean, I doubt if in American industry there are more than a half dozen people who, maybe Burke had it when Tylenol had it, but there aren't very many people who had that level of attention, probably. And I don't say that with great pride and enthusiasm. That's just the way it was. It was big stuff.
Let me ask you just a general media question.
Sure.
How did you find the media in terms of hidden agendas or the prejudices that were in place?
I would say, I have no way of knowing how many media people I talked to. I would pick a number, a couple hundred maybe, some number like that. There is only one instance out of all of those that I perceive to be biased and not entirely fair. I will tell you that. I mean, my approach to them was, look, you got a job and I got a job. The thing that had happened is you'd get 50 calls in an hour. Well, you can't possibly respond to 50 calls in an hour. So what I'd say to them is, look, I got to prioritize this stuff. Don't kid me now. Tell me when your deadline is. Tell me when I must call you. And somehow I'll get that done. And then I could sort them out, you know. And our reaction to that was, hell, nobody ever asked us about our problem before, you know. I mean, we always say we got to talk to you now, even though our deadline's midnight, because otherwise we'll never get you. And nobody ever thought about that. And so, but I get to see, and I always, I mean, I've never missed one, I don't believe, in all that time. So I kind of set a good tone with them. And of course, everybody knew I was. Nobody could ask me the "how did you ever let this happen" kind of question, right? So the questions for me were, "What are you going to do about it?" I was kind of ready for those. So I don't. With just one exception, will tell you that I was never treated, in my opinion, unfairly or improperly by the press. They ask hard questions and tough questions, and sometimes even mean questions. But I always believed that was kind of their job, and I tried hard to tell them when I didn't know something that I didn't know it, and it was a pretty professional relationship, and I have admiration for them. They did good.
That's good. It's good to know.
Yeah, no, I know I'm a minority who generally feels that way, but that's how I felt.
Well, we've covered a good number of these.
Yeah,
items on my agenda.
Highlight a couple of them that are interesting to you. You can tell by now I don't know much, but I have no problem talking.
Oh, no, this has been, it's been great. Let's go down here towards the bottom. What is important for the future vitality of chemical innovation?
It's a very interesting subject. I think about it. I mean, you get this question, well, has everything important been discovered? Are all the big products already out there? I mentioned earlier to you today, everybody wanted to work on advanced plastic material. Now today, most of those are pulling in their horns and are all kind of come back, and what's big? It's polystyrene and polyethylene and all of that, you know? So now you're a researcher and you're trying to find something that will be relevant to a $20 billion chemical enterprise. And research is very expensive. I mean, here's a Dow spending, I don't know, pick a number, $1.2 billion a year or something on research. And you got to earn a big return on that and make it matter for a $20 billion company. What's that going to be? That's hard. And it makes the job of research management difficult and frustrating because the financial guys are always saying to you, hell, I'd be better off taking your damn research budget and putting it in the bank and earning 10%. At least I'd have $120 million a year or something in profit instead of this big loss that I get every year. And not only that, I get my money back from the bank when I'm through. You guys, it's gone. And that complicates the innovative process, I think, a little bit. You know, I mean, so you put that there, and then you say, well, wait a minute, though. Here comes a guy named Bill Gates who figured out some half-assed way to make a program to make a computer work, and he's the richest man in the world, and he did all that in 15 years. Don't tell me there's no room for innovation. And where I come out on all that now, to kind of answer your question, I think there is lots of room for innovation in chemistry and chemical technology. The particular area that seems to me to just have immense promise going forward, at least from what I can see now, is this area of bioengineering and bio. I hate to use the word biotech because it's an overused word, but as we understand more and more about the human genome and which genes do what stuff and what changes them, I mean, it just, and I take all that and then I look at the demographics of the quality of people, what people are ready to pay for the quality of life, the demographics that everybody's living longer anyway. And I say to myself, just from a commercial context, let alone from a social and humanitarian, boy, there's a lot there. And it goes beyond just disease. For example, here I am talking to you. What are the chemical changes in my body that are occurring that cause me to talk to you or to think about what I'm going to say to you, or for that matter, what that make my jaws move? A lot of stuff there not well understood. And that's not rail cars of polystyrene. It might be milligrams or something, but oh, are those going to be valuable milligrams? I mean, I think all that's changing. And at the same time, there are still some very fundamental things in the rail car arena. I mean, nobody has yet figured out how to directly oxidize propylene to make propylene oxide. You and I did that this afternoon. We could buy Arizona. So, I think the horse is alive and well. All I hear some folks kind of every once in a while say the horse is dead. Like the patent guy in 1856 who said everything's been pretty much invented. Well, I think this is 1856 for the chemical business. I think there's lots there.
What do you see, though? You've commented about how much Dow spends on research.
Yeah.
And my impression is that a lot of places, either the research budget has gone down or it's more short-term oriented. And there's very little in terms of long-term.
Comes from this pressure on on profitability, on financial performance, allegedly productivity. I have, you know, you get into some pretty interesting arguments about how productive you can make, how efficient is maybe a better, you can make research. Because, you know, you slick it up and trim it up and have everybody have their little time card so they're always at the bench instead of thinking and looking off and dreaming. You get into interesting things about what's efficient and what's productive there. I think, and again, I don't have as broad an experience as I'd like to be able to draw on here, but I have to say this, and it will come across fairly critical, I think, in this interview, but I want to say it anyway. I believe industrial research has been significantly less productive than it might have been or should have been. And at least part of that is because it has been unnecessarily inefficient. Not all, but part. And I think of all of the management functions, management skills that are important in large chemical enterprises, the one I would tell you that's least developed is research management. I have met a zillion managers, research managers, general managers, chief executive officers, marketing managers, and if somebody said to me, okay, forget the discipline, just pick me the top 20 of the people, of all the people you've met, just for their inherent competence and ability to do what they do, I don't think any of them would be research managers. Not one. Not one. See, that's a bad deal. That's a bad deal. Why is that? I don't know quite why is that. I mean, I think you could make an argument that somebody who has spent his career learning how to be a brilliant researcher is unlikely to be a brilliant research manager and probably shouldn't be wasting his time doing that. People who aren't going to have the skills to become a great researcher probably don't start in it. And you can't be a great research manager without understanding a fair amount about research. So there's kind of a narrow cut there that is the raw material base. Does that make sense? I mean, you understand what I'm saying there? I think that's a little bit of the problem. You try to take a director of marketing at age 50 and have him be director of research, you're dead in the water. You can't do that. If you take a PhD chemist who's been 40 years at the bench and have him be that, you got to be lucky for them to be good. And there isn't a cadre of raw material. That's one problem. The second one that has always been an amazing thing to me, if I look at the top 100 highly paid people in a typical chemical company, I don't think I get to a research chemist. Mm. Top 100, not top 5. Top 100, I don't think I get to a research chemist. At least not anybody doing research. I might conceivably get to the director of research and development, who's a research manager, all right, somewhere up in there. And, I mean, I can find marketing executives, and I can find people running regions, geography people. I can find all that stuff. People running manufacturing plants, you know, I can find all that stuff. But here's this group of individuals whose inventions drive all that other stuff. Drive on. Now, they got to have all these other people to make them turn into a reality. But without the seed corn, nobody grows corn. And for years, I have kind of fought the system that defines the size and value of those jobs. A lot of people don't report to them. They don't have the capital budgets, all those things that go into what you should get paid for. You know, they can get 100% on intuition, but if that's only 10% of the total, you know, and so if I'm a brilliant young manager, I mean, if I was infinitely smart and it was square one, and I was deciding what I was going to be a manager of, and I could be the greatest research manager that ever lived, I probably still wouldn't go do that. Because I ain't going to get pump-off job doing that. See? Mm-hmm. So I worry about that, and here's a chance for me to kind of get that on the record somewhere, just some little guy out here in Arizona. But if I had it to all start over again and I had my own great big chemical company, I'd, by God, fix that. I would develop myself some professional research managers, starting at an early age. Possible to do that. When I was at Dow and got the communications function, we had no communications training ladder, no nothing like that. And what we did is hire a bunch of slide rules and teach them how to type, basically. And I said, God damn, guys, let's hire some typewriters and teach them how to run slide rules here. We need professional typewriters. I think maybe we need some professional research managers. We might even have to go our own to do that. But I'd tackle that. That's something I think's been amiss, and I think it's led to some of this lack of productivity and effectiveness. I mean, it struck me when I was briefly director of research and development for Dow. It strikes me to this day as remarkable how much feeling came to me from the research community because I had that job and the way I did it. I mean, I got plaques and I get letters and I'm getting invited every year to stuff, you know. And the research managers who kind of went all the way through that some reason or other didn't ever happen to. I know Pruitt's got a building named after him and all that other stuff, but I'm just telling you, in the same context, it ain't the same. And I worry about that. My only experience is Dow experience. At least my only indebted. But I listen to folks and talk to folks in other outfits, and I get a very similar kind of a thing. So, something to think about.
That's great. That's very good. I think our time may be just about up.
Yeah, we're in pain here.
Anything else you'd like to add at this point?
No, I don't think so. You got that long thing I did with Ned
right.
for the Dow side of that. You might, if you haven't seen it, just somewhere get the essence of what I said at that metal dinner. I mean, I really only said two things at that metal dinner. Let me just get them on the record here. One of them was, we in this industry, we've taken a lot of hits, we've done some things wrong, we aren't perfect, we were pretty defensive for a long time, you know. But we're in a business of working with some complicated and sometimes toxic materials, and once in a while something isn't the way we'd like it to be there. Recognizing that and saying it, then I say to you, if our objectives beyond the earth are quality and longevity of life, that's kind of the two things, to have a good life and to have it last a while, then I believe this discipline and this technology have done more for that than any other anywhere, period. And I really do believe that. I mean, I don't think you can pick any aspect of social behavior today or of society. I mean, kinds of fundamental stuff. Clothing, food, transport, all that. And you look at where they'd be without the advances in this technology, and I'll tell you, you know, this is the one. So I hope we kind of remember that as we talk about all the tribulations, that when somebody says to me, I think all the discoveries are done and the party's over, I say, read what that guy said in the patent office in 1856, man, you are smoking pot here. And I want to get that. So that's, I guess, my last salvo.
Yeah. Thank you very much for spending the morning with me. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. Now we have an afternoon for you. You can go out and bask around and see.
It's a beautiful day.
See, yeah, this is a nice day. You picked a good time to be here. And I appreciate your coming.
Thank you.